They're playing Ghost in the Graveyard this whole chapter. This is the ideal game. The perfect game of Ghost in the Graveyard. Clifford, back for another one.
Yes, indeed. How are you, Patrick?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing well.
Nice. All right.
So, we found ourselves at Chapter 8 of Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, yeah.
Fog on the Barrow Downs.
Yeah. Okay, so today we're basically going to have to... We basically just talk about what happens today. You know, pretty straightforward. But what? Obviously, we'll talk about leaving Bombadil's house. We'll talk about... journeying across the downs. We'll talk about getting captured by a Barrow White and you know what happens at the end there. Before that, Cliff's notes.
Okay, so Frodo and the gang wake to a beautiful morning at the house of Tom Bombadil, who feeds them well and preps their ponies for a fine day of adventuring. They intend to head north, skirting along the Barrow Downs, out of the forest into the East Road, which they hope to reach by nightfall. The day starts out splendidly, with views of the road from the tops of the hills they cross, but the sun grows more intense and the hobbits grow drowsy. Before they know it, dusk has fallen and a thick fog blankets the landscape. They travel in single file, with Frodo in the lead, but they get separated anyways. Frodo stumbles between two great stones, and his pony rears up and runs away. The shadows close in, and Frodo awakes in the ground on a bed of stone, with Merry, Pippin, and Sam asleep to his side. A skeleton hand is creeping its way around the corner, but Frodo strikes it down and sings the song Tom Bombadil taught him. Tom comes to the rescue once again, and he and Frodo pull the other hobbits back to daylight. Tom accompanies them to the road and sends them on their way to the Prancing Pony.
Nice. All right, so what did you think of this chapter? Initial reactions?
Pretty spooky. I'll throw it out there that it's maybe the perfect... or a fitting contrast to Tom Bombadil's house in the last chapter.
Okay.
For those of you who listened in, last chapter, we're hanging out with Tom Bombadil, who is this very mysterious and hilarious character. Something of a forest spirit, or maybe a god, or maybe nothing at all. Listen in to hear our discussion. But, by all accounts... very wonderful and pleasant for the hobbits, and this is just about the opposite.
Although agreed.
Similarly mysterious and mystical.
Yeah, I guess you're right that this is kind of the opposite of it, because, again, this doesn't really, I don't know, forward the story. It's just another adventure that they have to
We're still off in a little detour right now.
And this one's like, I don't know, I think this is the most bizarre thing ever. Because if you're not reading closely, you're just like, what is going on, you know? Like,
yeah.
You have to really follow along with the descriptions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it's still kind of vague, purely because everything's in fog.
Right, right. We have a sense of maybe the feel of the landscape, but compared to other chapters where we get detailed descriptions of who lives where, where the hedge is or the mountains, this is much fuzzier.
Yeah. All right. Well, so it starts out, though, that they leave Bombadil's house.
Mm-hmm.
Anything notable from that? It starts out with Frodo's having another dream. Another one. All this guy does is have dreams.
I thought he's not dreaming at the beginning.
Well, the beginning starts with Frodo heard a sweet singing running in his mind.
Okay.
A song that seemed to come like a pale light behind a gray rain curtain, and growing stronger to turn the veil all to glass and silver, until at last it rolled back and a far green country opened before him under a swift sunrise. That was definitely a dream.
Let me preface that. But either in his dreams or out of them, he could not tell which, Frodo heard a sweet singing. Anyway.
I skipped that line. Well, okay. Whatever. I think that's foreshadowing for something deep into the book, and we can't talk about it at all because that's quite a spoiler.
Okay. Well, fine.
All right. Well, it continues, though. Tom's whistling, as usual, being weird. And it was a clear day, and the hobbits, it said they had heavy hearts because it's like, we're going to have to go. We will have to leave today.
But it's a perfect day for it. Bright, crisp fall day. They say their ponies are almost frisky with how excited they are to get moving. So things are looking up.
That kind of sounds like a cross-country meet in the fall. Crisp, clear day. And
fresh-cut grass.
Yeah.
Rolling hills. Ooh,
man, that would get me nervous. Not really depressed, but... all right, well, so they leave. I don't know. Maybe we should kind of not just drag out every aspect of this chapter.
Point being, they get going, and things are good.
Notably, though, before they get going, though, Frodo, super distressed, he forgot to say bye to Goldberry.
Oh, yeah.
Another example that he was definitely into her.
Mm-hmm. If you remember from the last chapter, all the hobbits, but Frodo in particular, are sort of head over heels for Goldberry. Frodo broke into song when he saw her, and they basically couldn't take their eyes off her.
Yeah, do you think there's anything good to read in the first, two pages here about that?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading this at a coffee shop this weekend, and then all of a sudden, a jazz band starts playing there, and I was like, oh, shit. That was going to happen, but then I couldn't, they were good, but I couldn't focus.
Yeah.
As I was reading this, but yeah. I don't know, we can just keep moving on.
I am curious, would you be able to fill me in on some of the geography here? I know we're in this kind of fuzzy region in the map where we don't totally know what's going on.
Yeah, let me see. We're going east. That's the biggest deal.
They've got here. We got a nice description here. It was now as clear and far seen as it had been veiled and misty when they stood upon the knoll in the forest. This is back in 2 chapters ago, which could now be seen rising pale and green out of the dark trees in the west. So they got forest on the west. In that direction, the land rose in wooded ridges, green, yellow, and russet under the sun, which beyond lay hidden the valley of the Brandywine. This is back towards the Shire. To the south, go ahead.
Sorry, so this is behind them.
Mm-hmm.
West is behind. They're going east.
To the south, over the line of the Withwindle, there was a distant glint like pale glass where the Brandywine River made a great loop in the lowlands and flowed away out of the knowledge of the hobbits. Northward, beyond the dwindling downs, the land ran away in flats and swellings of gray and green and pale earth colors until it faded into a featureless and shadowy distance. Eastward, the Barrow Downs rose, ridge behind ridge in the morning, and vanished out of eyesight into a guess. It was no more than a guess of a blue and a remote white shimmer blending with the hem of the sky, but it spoke to them out of memory and old tales of the high and distant mountains. So, forest to one side, the river valley to the south, the plains to the north, and the mountains to the east.
Yeah, and the road is north as well. That's right. What they're going to try to make for. They don't want to go directly east because they don't want to go into the Barrow Downs. They want to go kind of northeast and skirt around them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were both wondering before this, there was no description of them walking through the forest at all. So does that mean, I guess, Bombadil's house is on the edge of the forest, in between the forest and the downs?
Yeah, that's what I've got a reason. If they're standing now in the downs, or the foothills, the Barrow Downs, and they see the forest off to the side, yeah, then I guess Tom Bombadil must live right at the edge of the woods.
Yeah, interesting. Because I imagine it was... It was like a kind of plain hilltop somewhere in the middle of the woods.
Yeah, I thought total woodland retreat, but anyways. So they're at this focal point where different landscapes are going out in every different direction, which means anything can happen right now.
Right. But so anyways, what? They start cutting north, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then halfway through the day, so around noonish, they basically think they see a line of trees out there and they assume that's the road being marked by that. So they came further than they expected, which is a positive.
Right.
Day's going well.
spirits are up, and they decide to have lunch on top of one of these hills, which...
All right, well, so that's another thing. Did they have it on top, or were they in the valley below?
Oh, let me dig into the notes. I'm not actually sure. I'm envisioning from the last chapter when we heard Tom Bombadil in his sort of ramble through time, where he's winding back the years of what he's witnessed and how he saw the creation of Middle-earth. He was describing the area that is now the Barrow Downs, of kingdoms rising and falling, fighting each other, kings being buried in the ground, and slowly the hills getting covered with grass. And all that remains are some of these hilltop fortresses of stone.
I don't know if there's fortresses. I think there was just, based on the description there, there was like just a bunch of jagged rocks. Like I'm imagining like Stonehenge kind of rocks.
Yeah, but definitely man-made.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. But I mean, but I don't think there were like real fortresses left.
Okay, fair.
I mean, maybe there were at some point, but I don't, they just kept saying like jagged rocks sticking out. I just imagine they were really creepy. I imagine like, it's not a good comparison, but you know, like 2001 Space Odyssey?
Yeah.
Like that big, like black, like monolith block that's just at the beginning with the monkeys.
And at the end.
Yeah, and at the end. But that I just imagine, awesome. I just imagine that thing being there. Uh-huh. I was like, what?
From architectural history class, those are called megaliths, which literally just means big stone. Lith
big
means...
big-ass rock, right?
Yeah. Lith means stone. Mega, big. So megalith. Monolith means one stone. And all over, basically, Stone Age civilization into like, the Iron and Bronze Ages. There's all sorts of these very peculiar and sort of haunting creations of just like large stones erected or assembled in different ways. Stonehenge is probably the most famous example, but in basically all over the world there's these basically like haunting ruins of just chunks of stone that some ancient civilization took a tremendous amount of time and effort to move into a significant place for some reason that we don't really know now. That's what this one can think of.
Well, yeah, and you're supposed to get that feeling like, man, this is like a really, really ancient people that were here before.
Right.
Moving, like doing whatever was going on here. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be creepy and make you feel like that.
Yes.
So, all right, so they're either on top of one of these mounds or they're in like the hollow. Either way, they are around like one of these big standing stones. And then they stop to have lunch and in typical Hobbit fashion, they fall asleep.
Yep. This reminds me a little bit of two chapters ago when they're sitting next to a lovely river and they decide to lean back against a willow tree and have a little snooze in the afternoon sun, and then the willow tree eats them.
Well, all right. So that one, though, I feel like that one was more like real deliberate magic going on there. Like that was the willow man's like power. Whereas here is like, okay, maybe there's some magic going on with like these standing stone things, but it's just like... You dopes. This is the first time you're actually doing well. Like, what are you doing? I don't know. Such a Hobbit move. Big Hobbit move there to fall asleep after lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all right. Well, so anyways, they wake up and then you want to read that quote right there?
Sure. The standing stone was cold and it cast a long pale shadow that stretched eastward over them. The sun, a pale and watery yellow, was gleaming through the mist just above the west wall of the hollow in which they lay.
Okay, so, yeah, so they basically wasted the whole afternoon and the sun's sinking down.
Mm-hmm.
They set out immediately, and they're very alarmed, but they know if they just cut straight north, they'll hit the road, which has been their goal the whole time, and they had seen it in the distance, right?
Right.
So just a straight line, that's all they gotta do, but they go slow because there's a bunch of fog everywhere, and they don't want to lose each other, and then the walking order was Frodo, Sam, Pippin, and Merry. Then it gets, like, real creepy, like, I'm just imagining, like... Like, if it was a movie, you'd be doing, like, real far-out shots of, you know, you can barely see them in the distance down there, you know, mm-hmm. and, like aerial shots, like, from, like, the top of a canyon as if they're walking through, you know? And then there's just these big, huge rocks that show up out of the fog as they're walking through on their ponies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, and so they approach a gap in the hills, and after that, the Barrow Downs are behind them. Frodo's encouraging, he urges everyone to hurry up and ride through. Yeah, so there's these giant pillars. So Frodo rides through them, and then he looks back, he falls off his pony, looks behind him, and everybody else is missing too. Frodo, instead of abandoning his friends, runs back in and starts calling out to him, and he's searching for him. And now everything's getting like pretty like chaotic now, because it's like what's going on? Because it was just fog. Like, how can you guys not stay together or whatever? So it must be serious that they can't be following through. He's hearing all the cries from everybody, but then they fade away. And then there's cold wind hissing, and stars are appearing, and Frodo's just like wandering all over chasing these voices. And you know, I feel like you can just imagine him getting all flustered and like not really seeing things, but just he doesn't know where he's at, like totally disoriented and everything. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden the wind blows the fog away, and he finds himself at the top of a great barrow facing south.
So yeah, per the book, they were almost at the north gate of the Barrow Downs, not quite, when they get stopped. So this presumably is like the edge of this spooky realm. And now he's kind of like trapped facing back into the middle of it.
The three others are just, you know, maybe captured by something. I don't know. It's hard to tell where they're even at.
Right.
Yeah, but then there's those lines there. You want to read the lines?
"Where are you?" he cried again, both angry and afraid. "Here," said a voice, deep and cold, that seemed to come out of the ground. "I am waiting for you." "No," said Frodo. But he did not run away. His knees gave, and he fell on the ground. Nothing happened, and there was no sound. Trembling, he looked up, in time to see a tall, dark figure like a shadow against the stars. It leaned over him. He thought there were two eyes, very cold though lit with a pale light that seemed to come from some remote distance. Then a grip stronger and colder than iron seized him. The icy touch froze his bones, and he remembered no more.
So this was the encounter with what?
A barrow white, we presume.
Okay, so let's take a little intermission and let's talk about what's going on here. So before we get to what the barrow white actually is, I want to do another note on geography, since we just described all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tolkien's basically doing here, and this story is an extension of Bombadil, because he was like in the Adventures of Tom Bombadil, like the thing that came out before Lord of the Rings. Apparently, he fought with a barrow white.
Right.
So the Downs are part of it too. Like, this is still his area, which makes sense if his house is like on the edge of both. It's not quite in the forest, but it's also kind of on the Downs or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And we had gone through too. Remember, the Shire is basically England, and probably more specifically, even Oxfordshire,
okay,
which is where he's from.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he lives when he's a professor, so that's most of his adult life. Then we had talked about the Withy Windle, how he could walk to there from his office. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we get to the Downs, which are just past the Old Forest. So if you walk 15 miles from Oxford, you're going to come to the Berkshire Downs. That's basically what he's going to mold the Barrow Downs off of.
Interesting.
So like, again, we're just like, he doesn't have any direction to the story at this point, so he just keeps writing stuff that he knows that's familiar to him, and so he's just taking him, you know, 15 miles away. And I'm pretty sure like him and C.S. Lewis, they like to do long hikes and stuff, so like it might not even have been like ridiculous to think that they walked that far out every once in a while. I don't know if they would do a round trip, but you know, 15 miles one way, they could probably do it.
Okay.
But yeah, so he's just, yeah, so he's moving around, though, just taking the hobbits across England, basically, until he can figure out a story. And then, yeah, he has all these adventures here. But they run into the Barrow White, you know, to have the adventure. And so you took the time to look up what these things really are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I usually think it's fun, you know, like, to toss you the ball every once in a while, just be like, all right, Clifford, I want you to be the expert on
mm-hmm,
this one.
Mm-hmm. Normally I get to play the fool, but so I have to say, it's not as exciting, or Barrow White specifically is a little bit of a Tolkien creation. Both Barrow and White have, you know, their roots in English and Old English, but throwing them together is a Tolkien creation from what I could tell.
All right. Which word are we going to deal with first?
Let's deal with White first and then Barrow. Because okay. I think Barrow is a little bit more interesting. White, basically just a ghost or a supernatural being, some sort of spirit.
I had read real quick that it could be like a corpse.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of interesting is that the derivative from like the old Germanic and the old English is related to creature and even little child. Mm. So it definitely is like has a much more animate origin, and then at some point became more of a supernatural thing over like as the language developed.
Okay.
Yeah, it's almost like it's used almost more like person, I think, in the older versions, and then it takes on a spookier connotation much later on.
Okay.
And there's some connection to Scandinavian, well, obviously it's a Germanic word, so it comes up in Scandinavian languages as well, and they may have associated it with some sort of ghost coming from graves, barrows. Mm.
Yeah.
So okay. Let's turn our attention to barrow, which okay. is not a super common word in American English, I believe, but some people might recognize it. It basically just means a mound or a burial mound, some sort of like hill, mountain type thing. The word is related to German Berg, which that comes like iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And in modern English, it's means specifically a burial mound.
Okay.
So I dug into the burial mound thing a little bit because that's a pretty interesting concept that I think we don't hear much of nowadays, but was super common in a lot of different cultures around the world. It's like this basically concept of putting people in giant mounds of earth as a burial instead of just a humble grave. And yeah. So you've got like examples a little bit like the giant stones that we saw depicted elsewhere in the chapter. There's examples of this all over the place in
like pyramids, right?
Yeah, in a sense, they're like primitive pyramids. You could think
the pyramids themselves are one example, right?
Yeah, the pyramids are like I'd say so much more intense. They're like a lot more architectural. Like they're more like buildings that have been assembled out of very prepared stone. Okay. This is, I'd say, a more primitive version of that, where it's just mounds of earth, sometimes mounds of stone, with varying extent of chambers carved out on the inside for graves. And typically, it's for nobles, or like people of higher social status. So my take is like it's basically a grave for somebody who's a big deal. So instead of just putting them in the ground, we're going to make the place where we put them a big deal. So point being, it's got origins around the world, or it's got bases around the world. Like you hear of Native American burial mounds. They're all over Northern Europe. They're all over the British Isles, Scandinavia. But then really almost anywhere in the world, you can find some example of this. And they're typically associated with burying kings or important people. Kind of like, I mean, once again, the pyramids are a good comparison. The pyramids are just like huge and really intense. But if you imagine like the ruler of some small territory gets put in this mound of stone in the ground along with swords and jewels and that type of thing.
I thought it was also too kind of probably just speculation, but it was like you could point to it and be like, this is where our ancestors are buried. And this is like our land here, you know, like mm-hmm. there's a claim.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good thing to mention is like in one sense, the stones and the mounds are both very classically human attempts to like mark the landscape and claim it. Say like we put a thing here and we've mm-hmm. now like defined this landscape as our own. And that comes up in some of these descriptions is like the idea of putting a king or something in a barrow indicates that he still has control over that landscape or he's still present, mm-hmm. which is obviously relevant to how this gets used in Lord of the Rings. Just a quick diversion. This doesn't tie in too closely to the chapter, but some interesting language stuff. So the proper term for a burial mound, I guess, is a tumulus, which is related to the word for like the root word for tumor, like bulge or swell. So if you imagine the ground like bulging or swelling out, which is pretty intriguing, and it's also related to cairns.
That's how you say it? Cairns?
Yeah, cairns. Like the pile of rocks when you're hiking.
Oh, I say cairn.
Cairn?
I don't know. We pronounce it differently.
Okay.
All right, go on.
Cairn comes from Scottish Gaelic. So the word is not specifically related, but historically there's overlap between the cairn means a pile of rocks and the barrow can mean a pile of earth or rocks. So they share some commonality. And the pile of rocks was interesting because it's like we're kind of looking at this landscape that's got the rocks along with the mounds of earth. So that seemed familiar. And then this was sort of like an interesting coincidence, but a Nordic variation of cairns is something called a hugr or hug, something like that. In the Old English, I think harg, which is like a stone, like some sort of stone cult site or altar, a little bit like a cairn, but like a bunch of rocks piled up on something.
Okay.
And that is tied to the root word for harrow instead of barrow. And harrow is, like, I think in contemporary English, we probably associate it first with fear, like something is really harrowing.
Yeah, harrowing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the reason that something is scary is because a harrow is like a type of plow that makes furrows, like cuts the ground into many pieces. And so if something is harrowing, it sort of splits you apart.
Mm.
So it's kind of like an interesting, not quite full circle thing where I felt like we've got this like suggestion of fear that's like tied together with this chain of words a little bit.
Isn't there a Harrowdale in Lord of the Rings? Isn't that like in Rohan? I think we're going to have
maybe
to get there. But
okay. I'll keep an eye out. Anyways, big diversion, but barrow is a burial mound. White is a ghost or a spirit. So very easily, barrow white is some ghost coming out of the ground tied to this sacred burial mound.
They're playing Ghost in the Graveyard this whole chapter.
Maybe so.
This is the ideal game. The perfect game of Ghost in the Graveyard.
Mm-hmm. With serious consequences.
Oh yeah. All right, so Frodo wakes up. He's in the mound, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's laying on some cold stone. And then there's the quote here. But though his fear was so great that it seemed to be part of the very darkness that was round him, he found himself as he lay thinking about Bilbo Baggins and his stories, of their jogging along together in the lanes of the Shire and talking about roads and adventures. There's a seed of courage hidden, often deeply, it is true, in the heart of the fattest and most timid hobbit, waiting for some final and desperate danger to make it grow. Frodo was neither very fat nor very timid. Indeed, though he did not know it, Bilbo and Gandalf had thought him the best hobbit in the Shire. He thought he had come to the end of his adventure, and a terrible end, but the thought hardened him. He found himself stiffening, as if for the final spring. He no longer felt limp like a helpless prey. So yeah, so we're setting the stage. So Frodo's in here. He's in like the middle of like, I don't know, worst place you could be right now.
Definitely.
Obviously.
Although this is a pretty, I don't know, good description for Frodo. He's come off as a bit like head in the clouds, not super useful or super courageous in the story so far. Besides his like personal journey to bearing the ring and everything, this is definitely like the most like adventure hardened we've seen him.
Yeah, agree.
This is a little throwback to Bilbo and the Hobbit, sort of steeling himself for yet another time where he's got to save the day.
Right, and I mean, like, the passage lays it out completely, too. It's like, he has to do this. He either does this, or he probably dies. You know, or he fails completely. Yeah, so what goes on here? So everything's, like, pale green, which I thought was really creepy, too, you know, like, yeah. And it's growing around them. He turns, and he sees his friends next to him, and they're on their backs. They have pale faces. They're wearing white clothes. They're surrounded by all sorts of treasures and swords. Mm-hmm. And there's one big, huge sword across all three of their necks, which is like, damn.
Yeah, sounds like they're about to be sacrificed or something. You know, it, like being dressed in white, surrounded by jewels. It's like they themselves, the hobbits, are going to be ceremoniously buried or something.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like a Norse thing.
Yeah.
Like, have you watched Vikings? There's a whole human sacrifice episode.
No, I haven't.
It's pretty weird. And then all of a sudden, too, to just continue to creep out the mood, they hear, like, cold murmur rising and falling, and it's super dreary. Like, sometimes the moan's, like, really high and thin, but then sometimes it's low and like really ominous and scary.
Basically terrible noises, yeah. But they're here.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole place is super grim, cold, you know, miserable, and yeah, just creepy.
Sounds like a crypt, or, I mean, just about right for some spooky burial situation.
And then there was that incantation. You want to read that?
Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone. Never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. In the black wind the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie, till the dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. Whoa. Dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. So this is, presumably this is the Barrow White ghost talking to Frodo and the hobbits, saying, I'm going to make you cold and hard and dead, and you're never going to wake again until the world ends? Or is he saying, I'm always cold and hard and dead, unless it's really, really dark and then I come awake? Or some bit of both? Help me out here. Also, who's the Dark Lord?
Hold on.
Also,
that was like five questions right there.
Unpack. Hold up.
Okay, so I think the first half is about what he's going to do to them.
Okay.
Never more to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. Oh, yeah, so that's at the end of time, because the sun and moon are going to get destroyed at the end of Middle-earth.
Okay.
But that's another topic.
Okay, but that means that is a long way of saying the end of time.
Yeah. The next two lines are still like, they're still about the hobbits just lying there dead. So the Dark Lord, all right, I know, like, at the end of this, they're going to talk about, like, the swords themselves.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to the swords.
Okay, so anyways, that song's going on, and then in the passage behind, around the corner, Frodo sees a long arm groping out, and it's reaching its fingers towards Sam, and, you know, at this point, Frodo is getting all freaked out, and temptation flashes through his eyes, where he's just like, you know, I could probably put on the ring here and escape solo, and, you know, I'd mourn for my friends, but, you know, Gandalf would understand, mm-hmm. right?
He'd know there's nothing I could do.
Yeah, so, you know, rationalizing it.
Right, and of course, he quickly catches himself, thank goodness.
The courage in him wouldn't even let him leave his friends. Like, even if he really wanted to, he was so inspired at this point. You know, like what we had been saying, or what that one passage that we just read, where he sounds like Bilbo. It's like, because of that, it's like, you know, leaving your friends behind isn't really even a question in this situation. Mm-hmm. And so he takes one of the swords that's laying around there, and he cuts off the hand of the arm that's reaching out, and then the sword splinters, there's a horrible shriek, light vanishes, you know, snarling noise comes up. Frodo, in that moment, he just starts singing the song that Tom Bombadil had taught them at the end of the last chapter, and as he sings it, his voice grows stronger, and then all of a sudden, he hears the answering voice of Bombadil coming through.
Old Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow. Bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow. None has ever caught him yet, for Tom, he is the master. His songs are stronger songs, and his feet are faster. Which is a great, great rebuttal, and then he goes on. Get out, you old wight. Vanish into the sunlight. Shrivel like the cold mist, like the winds go wailing. Out into the barren lands, far beyond the mountains. Come never here again. Leave your barrow empty. Lost and forgotten be, darker than the darkness. Where gates stand forever shut till the world is mended.
Nice. Yeah. So, yeah. So it's like, how did Tom get there? Like, what is this? You know, but I mean, do we even have to question it that much at this point?
We know Tom's got some tricks up his sleeve.
And this is like his, I don't know, not quite his domain, but it's like, yeah, this is his area, mm-hmm. you know? So he's, any of this kind of stuff, it's like, all right, we just go with it. He can do this. He's so quirky and magical,
yeah.
Anyways,
and, it's kind of,
this is not
why this chapter and the last chapter feel juxtaposed, just this is like the badge of Tom's good. He steps in here, saves the day, but it does seem like it's kind of a battle on his terms or something like that.
He's the ultimate authority, mm-hmm. out here. But yeah, so after that, the Barrow White leaves, never to come back, which is good. And then Frodo and Tom, they carry the other three out of the barrow, And then Tom goes back in to take some treasure, and he places it on top of the hill in the sunshine. So it's the next day, like morning of the next day. He sings him a wake-up song, and then the three wake up, and then Mary has the interesting line. He says, "Of course I remember it. The men of Carn Doom came on us at night, and we were worsted. Ah, the spear in my heart." He clutched at his breast. "No, no," he opening his eyes. "What am I saying? I've been dreaming. Where did you get to, Frodo?" And yeah, Frodo just wants to kind of move on and like not even recall the whole experience. But I mean, this is kind of interesting. So we're hearing that Mary,
he has a dream of being overtaken by these men, we don't know who they are, and basically them killing him.
So he might have had the dream of being the barrel, what, or being the people that would have been in the grave.
Oh, interesting.
Because they were probably killed by the Carn Doom men. So I think the people in the grave might actually be the good guys. Because they got killed by... I know the Carn Doom people, they're evil. They're from Angmar. Like, or okay, near Angmar. And that's, like, should tip off to a future villain in this story.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that was the deal. Was they were getting the vision of that. Now, does that mean that the Barrow White is a ghost or a corpse of one of the good men? That's the weird part that I don't quite get. But that, like, there's definitely some evil presence that somehow came about. But I don't think it's very clear what any of
that is. One thing that it made me think of what I was saying earlier. Carn.
Yeah.
Part of the reason I went down the Cairn rabbit hole with Barrow is that Carn is like an alternate Old Welsh form of Cairn.
Mm.
And I doubt that has specific relevance here, but I feel like it tied it full circle a little bit. Anyways, keep going.
Well, what? So then Frodo wants to go on, but Sam wants to change back into his regular clothes because they're robed in white, you know, super creepy.
Mm-hmm.
But Tom says they're not going to find their clothes. Pippin asks why not. And then Tom's answer is kind of weird, but it's, you found yourselves again, out of deep water. The clothes are but little loss if you escape from drowning. Be glad, my merry friends, and let the warm sunlight heat now heart and limb. Cast off these old rags. Run naked on the grass while Tom goes a-hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, yeah, back to his goofball self.
Yeah, what's kind of funny is, like, in this fuzzy, ill-defined landscape where we have a bunch of, like, rolling green hills.
Yeah.
That are, like, mounds of the earth. It's kind of like a Teletubby land, if you think about it. And he's, like, telling them to, like, run around naked like children. As the, like, the proper antidote to this horrific experience they've had.
Right.
Which is, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but let me just lay out, like, the rest of this here.
Okay.
So Tom comes back leading the six ponies, but, you know, the hobbits originally had five. Like, they had four and then an extra one for it to, mm-hmm. like, carry all their stuff. And then the sixth one is Tom's, named Fatty Lumpkin. And so, yeah, they were Mary's ponies, but Mary had never named them before. But they make the point to say that Tom said they answered to the new names that Tom had given them. And that was for, like, the rest of their lives as well.
A good sign of his powers.
Yeah. So, and then Tom decides, like, after that they're going to set off and he'll ride with them to the border of his own land. You know, he literally says that. A couple things there. Back to, like, that naked running on the grass. It's like, yeah, it's kind of funny, but, like... It's still, like, weird. It's like, is Tom Bombadil, like, some creepy old man or something? He wants to watch, like, kids swim or... I don't know.
Well, he's going away, so it doesn't strike me like that, but it is very, it is very weird.
Yeah. But anyways, Joseph Pierce, though, he, you know, actually takes the time to, like... address this. And okay. So he says this is actually, this goes back to the pre-fallen creature kind of thing, you know, like how we were talking about the last time.
Okay.
Because if you go back before Adam and Eve fell, you know, they were just naked and that was fine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's no like ideas about lust or anything, and like there's no need for clothing because, you know, you didn't know that you were naked, like you were innocent, right? Like that.
And we discussed in the last chapter Tom representing a pre-fall world in some way.
Like, he himself isn't a fallen creature, so it makes total sense that he would advise them, like, oh, you know, just act like how I would.
Yeah, or even more broadly, like, the antidote to the darkness.
Right,
And hatred that, or whatever that you've experienced is to try to, like, place yourself back in that innocence.
Also, the naming of the ponies, that's also probably a reference too, because in Genesis, when God creates Adam, he gives him the power to name all the animals.
Oh, interesting.
Just like how Tom names these ponies here.
Uh-huh.
And those names that Tom picks just stick forever, like period.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, pretty interesting there, because it's almost, are they bringing about, like, you know, whatever language Tom's speaking, it's like, is that like their true name, even?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, that's very cool.
Kind of go back to the last chapter if you want that full conversation about who Tom is, but...
Yes. Yeah. Another interesting aspect, Tom hauls all this treasure out of the barrow and sets it on top of the hill.
Yeah.
It's like gold, coins, jewelry, what have you. He gives the hobbits swords from some old daggers, which we'll get to in a second. But he spreads this treasure around, and then later on he says... He bade them lie there, free to all finders, birds, beasts, elves, or men, and all kindly creatures. For so the spell of the bound should be broken and scattered, and no wight ever come back to it. That makes me think, like, when we were talking about the barrows, and the sort of the significance of the barrow is a mark on the landscape, and also a collection of whoever that king or important person who's buried in the ground. It's like that, basically, their memory is concentrated there. And here Tom is sort of trying to like open it up and scatter the belongings from it.
Yeah, and that's interesting compared to The Hobbit, where we had Smaug's treasure, where even once he died, there's like the dragon sickness that was associated with it. Like
right.
It was kind of like a curse to have it. Whereas here it's kind of interesting because he's just like, all right, we're just going to disperse it. And then the Barrowite's done for good.
Right.
So
it's almost like...
So it seems like the opposite is kind of going on.
Here, like... helping to dismember the memory of that barrow and that person helps destroy the barrow white or keep it away,
yeah.
Which I thought was a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah.
So
the swords, let's do the swords.
Yeah.
You want to read that?
For each of the hobbits, he chose a dagger, long, leaf-shaped, and keen, of marvelous workmanship, damasked with serpent forms in red and gold. They gleamed as he drew them from their black sheaths, wrought of some strange metal, light and strong, and set with many fiery stones. Whether by some virtue in these sheaths or because of the spell that lay on the mound, the blade seemed untouched by time, unrusted, sharp, glittering in the sun. Old knives are long enough as swords for hobbit people, he said. Sharp blades are good to have, if shire folk go walking, east, south, or far away, into darkened danger. Then he told them that these blades were forged many long years ago by men of Westerness. They were foes of the Dark Lord, but they were overcome by the evil king of Carn Doom in the land of Angmar. Few now remember them, Tom murmured. Yet still, some go wandering, sons of forgotten kings, walking in loneliness, guarding from evil things, folks that are heedless. The hobbits did not understand his words, but as he spoke they had a vision, as it were, of a great expanse of years behind them, like a vast shadowy plain over which there strode shapes of men, tall and grim with bright swords, and last came one with a star on his brow. Then the vision faded, and they're back in the sunlit world. Sounds like some foreshadowing there.
Yeah, pretty cool. So, well, you clearly said it there. The swords are from the good guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it sounds like the good guys are the ones buried here. Though I think it was some other evil force that caused the barrow white to be there. Like, it's not like the good guys died and then some evil ghost thing came from them.
Well, so that's what I wanted to ask about. So there's a handful of different things. We've got the fact that there's this conflict between men. There's the men of Westerness who are good. There's the evil king at Carn Doom, who I'm presuming was a man.
Yes.
And then the men of Carn Doom, but they're in the land of Angmar, which we remember from the Silmarillion is where Morgoth was, right?
Oh, no, you're getting it confused. Easy to confuse. Morgoth's from Angband.
Oh, okay. Angband. Okay, who's in Angmar? Right.
Angmar is, well, it's just what they're saying here, this evil king. And it's going to be, all right, it's a character in Lord of the Rings, but I don't
know. Okay, I know.
Yeah, you got it. But Angmar is, I mean, it's kind of around here, obviously, because they would have a war. But it's further north towards the Misty Mountains, like kind of further up north of the Misty Mountains, like north of Rivendell.
Okay.
But on this side of the Misty Mountains. So,
okay.
So they came down and they were battling the men of Westerness who, have we talked about Westerness at all yet?
Not really. Not at all, I think.
I guess we could start a little bit. You know, just I'll freestyle a little bit here.
Okay.
So we remember from the Silmarillion, there's a bunch of elves battling Morgoth to get the Silmarils back.
Right.
All right. Three tribes of men actually come over and help them. And so at the end of the Great War with Morgoth, their reward is that they get to, they can't go to Valinor because Valinor's for immortal creatures. And like the men would just, you know, die very quickly if they went there. Mm-hmm. But what they can do is they pull up this, like, resurrect this, like, island in the middle of the Great Sea between Valinor and Middle-earth, and it's two-thirds of the way towards Valinor,
mm-hmm.
and they give that island to men, these three tribes of men, to live on and, like, multiply and be fruitful,
mm-hmm.
and that island's called Numenor, so if you ever hear Numenorians, this is where they come from.
Okay.
But eventually, there's a whole detailed story of what happens to that, but that island eventually gets destroyed because of actions of men.
Okay.
And some people escape from that destruction and they come back to Middle Earth and they set up two kingdoms, one in the south called Gondor and then one here in the north called Arnor. And so these are the men of Westeros that would have been battling against Angmar. And so it must be their graves that they're at right now.
Okay. So long storied line of good guy men.
Yeah, and that's, like, what they were talking about here, like, the vision. They saw a great expanse of years behind them, and, like, a vast, shadowy plain. They saw strode shapes of men. So, tall and grim with bright swords, and last came one with the star upon his brow. They're referencing these kinds of people.
Okay.
We don't know exactly who they're referencing yet. This is foreshadowing, but eventually you can probably kind of pick it out who's who here.
Okay. So, pretty interesting. I wanted to double back real quick. So the little song that the Barrow-wight speaks or sings to Frodo, where he ends, "Till the Dark Lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land," certainly sounds like a lot of doom and gloom. Whoever this Dark Lord is literally wants everything to die. And then in the previous chapter, when Tom was sharing all these stories with them, we hear there were the kings of little kingdoms fought together, and the young sun shone like fire on the red metal of their new and greedy swords, presumably, maybe some of the swords that the hobbits are now holding. There was victory and defeat, and towers fell, fortresses were burned, and flames went up into the sky. Gold was piled on the biers of dead kings and queens, and the mounds covered them, these are the barrows now, and the stone doors were shut, and the grass grew over all. On and on. A shadow came out of dark places far away, and the bones were stirred in the mounds. Barrow-wights walked in the hollow places with a clink of rings on cold fingers and gold chains in the wind. So, some shadow coming out of the dark places is bringing these Barrow-wights back to life somehow.
Yeah.
And then, later on, we've got mention when Tom is winding his timeline back. He made paths before the big people, and he saw the little people arriving. He was here before the kings and the graves and the Barrow-wights. When the elves passed westward, Tom was here already, before the seas were bent. He knew the dark under the stars when it was fearless, before the Dark Lord came from outside. So, you tell me, are these all related? Are they the same thing?
All right, so anything dark and evil is probably related.
Yeah.
But I think these are two different Dark Lords in this situation.
Yeah. So this is kind of, if you're paying closely, we've got mention of spooky things afoot. But I want to see if we can fit together any pieces at this point in the story. So we've got that shadow that's bringing the Barrow-wights back to life. There's in the really ancient time, like creation of the world, there's the Dark Lord coming from outside.
Right.
Then there's, in this chapter, we have the Barrow-wight alluding to the Dark Lord who lifts his hand over Dead Sea and Withered Land.
Okay, so the Dark Shadow that's playing with the graves is different from the Dark Lord that came from the outside at the beginning of time.
Okay.
All right, so that guy is...
Fair. They're in different weight class, maybe.
Yeah. I think the Dark Lord from the outside, I think he gets capital D, capital L. Whereas the one in the song here, whereas the other guy probably doesn't.
Okay.
Now, there's two possibilities, and the Dark Lord from the outside, that's Morgoth, like Melkor.
Okay.
Whereas the one playing with the graves My guess, and I want to kind of state who this is without spoiling it, I think it's related to somebody from Angmar.
Okay.
As opposed to the other option would be Sauron himself, which I don't think it's actually Sauron.
Okay. We'll stay tuned.
And then the one in the incantation, I think that might have been referencing actually back to the Dark Lord.
The big or bad
that,
Dark Lord.
That could reference, yeah, or that could just reference Sauron too.
Okay.
Or, I don't know, it could be any of the three.
Okay. Yeah. But it's all connected.
Yeah. We got to finish it up here, though. Oh, one weird thing, though, about these swords. There's a line somewhere that the hobbits, like, Tom gave him the swords and he's like, fighting had not before occurred to any of them as one of the adventures in which their flight would land them. Which is like, really? You didn't think? What? Really? You didn't expect that you need swords to fight? But we got to wrap this up now.
Okay. So
all the questioning.
Definitely. Tom says, I'm going to look after you guys. Clearly, these are dangerous parts. So he walks with them, or trots with them, on down to the road. And it turns out the road was way further away than they expected.
Yeah, what they had seen was like a wall from an ancient kingdom. And that kingdom would have been like basically kind of like border shiftings of like between the wars of these men and then the other original, like the good Arnor kingdom. Mm-hmm. And like that had different divisions within it, and this was probably one of those divisions related to the ancient kingdoms of men again. And all those standing stones probably are as well from the beginning of the chapter.
Right. Okay. But they make it at last to the road, and Tom has to say goodbye. Sadly, Tom's country ends here. He will not pass the borders. Tom has his house to mind, and Goldberry is waiting. Kind of, he's pretty much a little bit like Bjorn in The Hobbit. Clearly a very powerful figure, but saying, my work here is done, and I don't step foot beyond these boundaries.
Well, I mean, there was I think it's more, he's more tied up to here than Bjorn is, because Bjorn goes all the way to the Lonely Mountain and fights in that last battle. Whereas here, like, Tom literally has a line, he's just like, out east my knowledge fails. Tom is not the master of riders from the Blackland far beyond this country. Yeah, I mean, we were talking about he's like the unfallen person, and he's out here, and this is kind of his domain. But and like he's not even affected by the Black Riders, but still, like if he goes further out, you know, he's kind of useless almost. And yeah, he's not like all powerful that, you know, he can go walk up to Sauron and defeat him or anything. Like,
right.
Yeah, and somehow he's only boxed in here.
It gives an interesting dimension to our discussion from the last chapter, where Tom is like almost defined by his landscape a little bit. Like he's the master of his woods and streams and animals, and in some ways it seems like that might give him his presence or his existence or something like that. And if he goes beyond that, he ceases to exist a little bit.
Yeah, one of the books I was reading, they had suggested that he's a person whose joy in life is to depend on blocking out unpleasant realities. So it's not like, I mean, I don't know. That is kind of like, I don't know, he's really cool and everything, but it's like, that's kind of a slightly a bummer way.
They're accusing him of being sort of like a hedonist or something, or like...
Or like, well, I think like ostrich head in the sand. I don't think they would say he's a hedonist at all.
Wrong description.
He's like the unfallen person. Like, it's just like he has no knowledge of evil. You know, he doesn't know how to comprehend it because he's just like the goofy.
And therefore, he's not obligated to confront it.
Right. Yeah, that's part of it too. Yeah, I would say so. But yeah, he has to leave. He tells the hobbits go to Bree, which is a city, and then go to the inn at the Prancing Pony. And Frodo reminds the other hobbits that. He's going to go by Underhill instead of Baggins for his name. Sam departs singing an ancient language, which, again, another reference is that, like, the unfallen language. And then you want to just read those last two paragraphs to close this out?
Sure. I wanted to read Sam's quote because I thought it was a nice ending for Tom Bombadil, one of my favorite characters.
Go for it.
I am sorry to take leave of Master Bombadil, said Sam. He's a caution and no mistake. I reckon we may go a good deal further and see not better nor queer. So that was a good description of him. I have never heard somebody be described as a caution and no mistake. But anyways, They now mounted their ponies and rode off silently into the evening. Darkness came down quickly as they plodded slowly downhill and up again, until at last they saw the lights twinkling some distance ahead. Before them rose Bree Hill, barring the way, a dark mass against misty stars, and under its western flank nestled the large village. Toward it they now hurried, desiring only to find a fire and a door between them and the night.
All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Yes, we are.
We just finished a long episode, long one.
We did indeed.
It's late
and tired. I've been pretty tired, frankly. A lot of travel. I just started my new bike commute, which is exhausting.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right. But... well, then, you know what? We're going to let you sleep. We're going to read a review, and then we'll just get out of here.
Okay, great.
Okay. This review comes from Who Shot Dave. So Dave, send us an email to talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com. That's talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com.
Spelled out. Like yeah.
Yeah. Okay. He says, great podcast, 5 stars. Of course, 5 stars. That's the key. That's how you get the beer koozie. These guys definitely know their token. And it's really fun listening to them talk through all the books. Love the chemistry of the two hosts, too. All right, cool. Simple, good.
Awesome.
That's a winner. All right. Thanks a lot, Dave. And, yeah, anything else? Oh, you know, keep checking the Instagram. What's the Instagram called?
Talking Tolkien Podcast.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. I was actually asking. But yeah.
I think it is. I'll check now.
It might just be Talking Tolkien.
You're making me doubt myself now. No, it's Talking Tolkien Podcast. I'll spell that.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, that's what it is. We're putting up all these characters. Please rate them on a scale of 0 to 10 for how creative of a character they are. It's for a special project that's going to be super, super fun. So please help us out and do that. Go back. It won't be weird if you just scroll back for, like, the past month that we've been doing this, but just go for it. Rate them all. All right. You got anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, let's leave it here. Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week.
Thanks, y'all.